Does the conductor need to be able to play every instrument to the artistic level of the number one violist and the number one cello player and the number one bassist or stuff like that? No. Right? The role of the leader is to be the conductor of the orchestra. But even that has artistry, because if it wouldn't, we wouldn't differentiate between like the New York Symphony and some kind of like small town high school band. So that recognition, artistry in basically the instrument, artistry in surgery, artistry in how we lead our business, is the aspect that goes above and beyond the expected procedure. And it takes talent, it takes obviously energy, vision, it takes the willingness to try.
What's better than earning money from a 9-to-5 job? It's earning money while you sleep, which is made possible if you start investing. You're listening to the Real Estate Investing Demystified with your very own dynamic duo, Ava Benesaki and August Binez. Tune in as we discuss everything real estate, both on the passive and active sides. We feature life-changing stories of today's real estate leaders that will help build your own roadmap to success. This is a show that will lead you to a diversified portfolio, a much bigger revenue, and a next-level venture that brings you a smooth cash flow. Let's get this episode started.
All right, welcome back to Real Estate Investing Demystified. We have an incredible show for you guys today. I just wanted to say something. A lot of the viewers and a lot of people who know you, August, they know August as a chief investment officer and as a real estate private equity guy. But unbeknownst to you guys, August is actually a military and geopolitics expert, and he does many talks around the world to huge audiences. And that audience consists of myself, my one-year-old Apollo, and my two-year-old Atlas. So we believe in him. And, you know, one day I think he'll really go big.
Yeah, I'm really trying to grow my audience in that sphere. Right now I'm focused on real estate and private equity. But yes, I'm also an expert in that space. But it's something that affects life. I mean, politics, geopolitics, wars taking place as is happening currently, It affects our everyday lives. Gas prices have gone up 35%, at least here in Southwest Florida. But they're part of our lives. And it really excites me. I think if I wasn't in business, in finance, in real estate, I would definitely either be in the military or politics. That's
100%.
That's where I want our sons to go. I definitely want our sons to get involved in politics. They're both born here in the U.S. They're Americans. And they, you know, hopefully one day they will be involved in initially military, but eventually the politics, because politics matters. So
yeah, you know, and our two-year-old's really taking a liking to learning all of this stuff as well, because daddy is very passionate about it. So
exactly. Yeah, but touching on the current war in Iran, it seemed like it was a war that they were really setting us up for. We knew that it was gonna be, you know, Afghanistan went down, and then it was Iraq. It was, you know, soon after, obviously in recent time, was Syria, and then now Iran, to finally that goal that was put into place by Israel and the U.S. finally took place. And American and Israelis attacked Iran, killed the supreme leader on the first day of the war. I mean, usually the leader gets killed a little bit farther down, but they killed him on the first day of the war. But we're kind of watching at what's happening. Me, as myself, as an Iranian, Canadian, Iranian, American person whose heart has always felt American, even at the times when Iran was going to a war with Iraq and Iraq was using American weapons or American planes and bombs to bomb Iran, I still felt American. I wanted to end up here one day, and that's why I came here, and both of my sons were born here. So I have that affinity with the U.S., with the idea of United States. But when the U.S. is attacking Iran, a lot of people ask me about my feelings. How do I feel about it? And the best analogy I've come up with is as if, you know, as a country of Iran, as an Iranian, the Islamic Republic feels like a cancer, feels like Iran is having cancer. And what the Americans and Israelis are doing is basically chemotherapy for that cancer. So chemotherapy is still hurting you, still killing you in the process of killing the main cancer. But so that's how it feels. It feels like a patient having cancer and getting chemotherapy to try to relieve it from this cancer that exists in Iran. But our guest today is going to be discussing, you know, he comes from a military Air Force background. Interestingly enough, he served for the Air Force in Germany and the U.S. And, you know, not too long ago in history, when you look at it, Germany was at war with the U.S., with the Allies, and the German army did tremendously well. The German Air Force did tremendously well, but they were defeated, which changed fabric of the world, which resulted in half the world, the eastern part of the world, becoming communist with the Soviet Union expansion and what have you. So these things that happen every day, some of us just leave it on the sideline, but it affects our everyday life. So we're going to get our guests to jump on, and yeah, maybe we can get our guests to come on, Ava.
Yeah, absolutely. Today, we're joined by Axel Meerhoover. Welcome to the show, Axel. We're really grateful that you're here with us today.
Yeah. Hi, August and Ava. Thank you for having me.
Incredible. Yeah. Prior to the show chatting with you, it's obvious you have a German accent. How did you serve in the U.S. Air Force? Obviously being German, or at least having a German background.
Yeah. So what happened is I joined what's called Flight Test Organization in Germany, which is basically, if you think about it, a combination or cooperation of civilian companies who build military planes and also civilian planes and the military. And in that particular case, I joined the test team organization to develop a new version of the plane that I had been flying in regular service. Most of the time, these pieces of equipment, August, you mentioned, you know, like large military budgets in the US and a large military industrial complex. So it's kind of obvious that a lot of the top smartest technology would come from American companies. And if you think about it, when you're actually in testing, there are no books already made. There is no military philosophy. If a company builds a piece of equipment, they build it from an engineering perspective. And then when meaning like when I was in the Air Force, wanted to translate it, there was no other way than going to these companies. So for about 2 years, over and over and over, my wife and I, we went to American companies in the United States for me to get the training. And at some point, my wife said, you know, it would actually be nice if we could have a longer stay than just these like 4, 5, 3 weeks at a time. I looked into this and found that there was actually a long-standing exchange program between the U.S. Air Force and the German Air Force. So I applied for it, long story, and then ultimately got selected. So the director of flight operations of a U.S. fighter wing came to take my job. At the time, I was responsible for theoretical flight training, like, you know, all the theory you need to learn to be ready to go into the plane. So he took my job and I took his job. And so he learned how to fly the plane I was flying, and I learned to fly F-111s. And that's how that actually happened. And I did that F-111 flying for not quite 3 years. And then I was reassigned. I thought I would go back home, but I was actually reassigned to another U.S. base, actually the home of the stealth fighter, the F-117 in New Mexico, and helped to build U.S. Air Force, German Air Force Combined Flight Training Center.
Wow.
And then I got too old and I retired.
Okay, great. But talk to us about that transition bit as well, because that, instead of just getting training in the U.S. and going back and training your compatriots, you were actually now moved to the U.S. I guess you're getting paid as a U.S. Air Force officer, right, as well. And how was that transition like? Was there things that Americans did better than the Germans? Was there things that the Germans did better than Americans? How was your first glance at it? Because I know we're looking at just, for example, American-made cars compared to German-made cars. You can tell the difference right away. I don't know. My Cadillac Escalade drives great, but our Mercedes is not bad as well. But love to hear your feedback there.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard sometimes to put things in these kind of black and white, right or wrong kind of comparisons, because in my experience, the older I get, the more I realize things are not just two sides of a coin or something like that. There are all kinds of shades of grays and different variants. So to point out a few things, one thing I would say, since I experienced both, what the US side or the US military does much better on the internal affairs, so to speak, is really taking care of their own, right? If you look at a U.S. Air Force base, you have a commissary, you have a hospital, you have a dental clinic, you have an oil change place, you have a little shop, you have housing, and on top of that, all the things necessary for operations. If you go comparatively to a German Air Force base, you basically have only the things that you need to operate, like for a fighter wing, like I was in, you have a runway and you have technical buildings and you have some barracks and stuff like that and some office buildings and so forth. And everything else is external in the community. So the camaraderie aspect, this like really feeling being taken care of. Like, I mean, maybe between the two of us, what was completely foreign for my wife was that there was like an officer's wife's club. Right. And so she was on the one hand already a little exotic as the only like non-American person on the whole base. And then because of my rank, you know, I mean, you have obviously a much larger number of people. So if you are like a major or lieutenant colonel, you're already kind of like further up in the picking order. The top rank, by the way, in the bases that I was stationed was a colonel. So I was kind of like two levels away from that. So that's the other kind of funny thing that wouldn't fly at all in Germany is that the women treated each other as if they had the ranks of their husbands.
Wow.
You know, so she came back from the first time and she said, they all called me Major Meyerhofer's, you know, wife, so to speak, or ma'am or stuff like that, as if I had done anything. So that was a little bit different. So back to your question, the internal thing is really a strong community, which is way less in comparison to Germany. The other part, the external thing that I even had to get used to because I was so totally not used to it, is the enormous appreciation that the US public has for service members. Right? Like, I was completely shocked. I was actually starting to wonder if people meant it seriously when they said, thank you for your service.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yes, I provided 22 years of service. It's all true. And it's super, super appreciated. You know, like makes me actually a little emotional, to be honest. But it totally didn't exist. I mean, I don't want to poo-poo it too much, but there were times where people in my unit in Germany were asking for permission not to have to wear uniform on the way home because it took them through the center of the city and they always felt like they're sticking out and running the risk of basically being like, look at this idiot who is actually serving for the military, right? So that's a really, really different environment. To me, it took us like 2.5 seconds to get used to, you know, but it's still every once in a while, you had to ask yourself, you know, wow, this is really very different. Now, one thing I want to also say, August, to your question, because that is sometimes forgotten, and I think it was really, really important. The service in the other military's organization, like me as a German Air Force officer serving in the US Air Force, was really absolutely complete. So if what is going on right now with Iran would have happened at the time, I would have flown the F-111s in the Strait of Hormuz. There was no such thing like you kind of half there and not really. And if something happens,
we'll get to that point. Very important.
I'm just saying, you know, like it was a really complete. I had that job. I was part of the unit. I wore the same U.S. uniforms. Everything.
You would have been deployed. Basically, you're saying
It's basically like you really becoming a member of the other service. And it's same thing. Like if there would have been something in Ukraine and Germany had decided to participate, my counterpart would have basically been part of that.
Wow.
And I just wanted to point out that we had to sign that we completely understand that we are now part of the other service and no longer of our kind of home country service.
Going back to a couple other things, I'm going to touch on this a bit, but you have to take this with the idea, the understanding that there is restrictions on Germany, even as of today, for any type of military expansion. I think there is restriction on developing fighter jets or so. There's 30,000 American troops that are stationed in Germany. And also keep in mind, after World War II, the German as a people, they were forced to put their head down in shame of what the Nazis did to the world and the whole Holocaust and everything else. So maybe the ideas of being patriotic and being a military officers was shunned upon because of that history, not because people don't appreciate what they've done. But Americans, touching on this as well, what I noticed as a Canadian who lived in Canada most of my life and coming to the US, they're not only more patriotic when it comes to their servicemen and people in the military, they're also more patriotic when it comes to sports. Many other things Americans do. They're just more patriotic as a nation when it comes to their flag, when it comes to their national anthem. They're just more exciting. It might be because of the heat. It might be because the type of people that came from Europe and settled in the United States. I see the Canadian counterparts as much more risk averse, for example, when it comes to the investing world. I see them much more, maybe almost borderline antisocial. The Canadians are. They like being in seclusion. Americans are much more outgoing and exciting. So there is those factors as well. But going back to the question that I had for you about what the Americans did better, you talked about that outside of the military when it comes to availabilities, that maybe that's because of the budget, maybe because of the passion that people have, that military people did live the maybe more excitement there. What was it better than the Germans did than the Americans?
Well, the one thing is that you don't constantly have to ask the question, do we have budget for things that should be, in my opinion, and in the opinion of any like military member, should be a normal thing, right? And that has obviously part to do with how big the overall budget is, but it's just a common understanding that if you want people to voluntarily serve in the military, which is kind of the system that we have in the US, that you need to provide a lot of things. But there's also then this component of largesse. I give you one quick example of a real contrast that I experienced. I came to this unit, did my training, and then took this role of director of operations. And I walk into a room where you normally plan your missions, you're making your maps and preparing your stuff and making a plan. And there were these shelves and shelves and shelves with binders. And I had never seen something like that. So I walk in and get kind of the tour, and I stop the guy who gives me the tour and said, what is this for? There can't be that many binders to plan missions. He said, no, these are all the SOPs, the standard operating procedures that basically describe pretty much anything and everything that can happen between accepting the plane from maintenance, flying the plane on whatever mission you can imagine, coming back and giving the plane back to maintenance. And I looked at that, I'm like, wow, that's crazy. I mean, we had maybe 5% of those number of binders that they had. So I ultimately, as I got a little bit more accommodated and got to talk to the crews, and I was planning a mission, and I pointed and said, guys, all this stuff here, they said this is all your SOPs. They had just come back about a year and a half before from the Iraq war at the time. So I said, did you literally take all of this to Iraq and then make sure that you... They said, no, they all stayed here. When we went to war, we didn't have any use for these SOPs. And that is the one of the stark differences to the German system. The German system, and I kind of hinted to this before we started recording, Eva, is really, really goal-oriented. So you identify a common goal, but you're not necessarily saying, here are 12 binders that describe you how from where we are right now to accomplish this goal. It says, here is where we are, analyze your current situation, look at what we want to accomplish, and find a way. You mentioned the German military in World War II or even in World War I. I think if you really ask the strengths of the Allies versus this comparatively small military that Germany had, that difference that is still in existence today, I believe made a huge difference, because some very gifted, especially tactics and strategy gifted people, found ways. Not because they were in binders, not because they were in books, not because they were in checklists. They found ways to accomplish the goal. And sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. Most of the time when they did, they had surprised somebody. Mm-hmm. So that is a really, really big difference that I had to get used to. Because if you have that many rules, that also means you're constantly walking the, on the edge of doing something wrong and breaking a rule. I had the great pleasure of actually, and you can debate if it's a pleasure or not, but a few things that I brought from Germany about how we actually conduct our missions with the German military had to do with how to be very successful in hitting the target. And so I had the great pleasure of teaching those things to my fellow pilots in the wing, and we became in the wing the best squadron of the wing because we kind of did it the German way.
I love that. Yeah, the SOPs, I mean, we're very familiar with that because I've literally built out so many SOPs in our company here, but it really is about getting the right person in the right seat. So they probably really focused on that, obviously, first.
It's also about being pragmatic and not perfectionist, following rules to a fault, but rather being pragmatic. But
it might slow you down, and then, yeah, you might make
it. We have a lot to cover. So Let's go on. I'm going to be putting you on a little bit of a hot seat here, Axel, my friend. So I have an image pulled up here. It's President Trump in the Situation Room. He's sitting next to Marco Rubio. He's sitting next to J.D. Vance, his vice president, and few others. I want you to picture yourself in that room. And in this room, he also has the Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's got the Israeli Prime Minister on his screen talking with him. Obviously, the Israelis have had a bone to pick with the Iranians for a long time because of their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, and so many other things that have happened over the years. They seem arch enemies, but in 1979, pre-79, they were best friends when the Shah was in power. And even it was fashionable for Iranians to go get surgery done in Tel Aviv and come back and so on. So it's weird how the world has changed. But you're sitting in this Situation Room with President Trump, and the New York Times has published a report on this. So on February 11th, you have Netanyahu that comes to the White House. He's there in Situation Room. The Mossad is on the screen behind him. And basically, they're discussing the Iran situation. They're discussing this idea of regime change. That's the goal, to topple the regime, right? So again, you're sitting in this room. So they're talking about missile program. Some people within Trump's administration, within Trump's military, are worried about the Strait of Hormuz. They're worried about the missiles that Iran has. But the Israelis are telling them that we're going to blow up all their missile stockpiles. We're going to blow up all their tunnels. They won't even have an opportunity to use these missiles and close the Strait of Hormuz. The retaliation against U.S. interests would be minimal. That's what they tell Trump. And Trump turns around and says, sounds good to me. And every one of those assurances has turned to be wrong. The Strait of Hormuz is closed. Well, Iran and the U.S. and Israel are in a two-week ceasefire. But one of the Iran's requests was that Lebanon doesn't get bombed. And the Israelis are bombing Lebanon as we speak. So they probably don't want this ceasefire to go on. But anyhow, what happens here is that Trump turns to his advisors. So he turns to J.D. Vance and ask J.D. Vance, what do you think I should do? J.D. And this is, again, like I mentioned, this is actual factual from the New York Times. It's an actual report. And J.D. Vance says, you know, I think this is a bad idea, but if you want to do it, I'll support you. Marco Rubio says, if the goal is regime change, we shouldn't do it. And then the Chong, the comms director, contradicted everything they said for 8 months about Iran nuclear facility being destroyed. He's saying that, hey, if you guys go ahead with this, this contradicts that we blew up their military, that we blew up their nuclear facility. So why are we even doing this? The CIA director says regime change was possible if we just mean killing the supreme leader. He's like, regime change is possible if it only means killing the Ayatollah Khamenei. So after hearing all of this, and they don't even have the Treasury Secretary or the Energy Secretary, two of the people who are going to manage the largest oil supply disruption in history, in the room. So anyways, the Trump makes a decision to go ahead. And the next day, aboard Air Force One, 22 minutes before military deadline, Trump sends six words. Operation Epic Fury is approved. No aborts. Good luck. A New York Times says this. So you're sitting in that room. What's the advice you give the president of the United States in this situation?
Well, the first thing is, it's not just being asked and giving advice as if you were brought in for 1 minute and then have to leave a minute later. So I would have wanted to know before I even say anything, where does the urgency come from, right? Because I have the strong suspicion the urgency comes from Israel. And my advice would be, well, my next question would have been, and similar to Marco Rubio, do we mean regime change, like Kath Patel said, or do we mean we want to free the Iranian people? And if you want to, I would say to Trump, if you want to be the person who is no longer known for not going to war, then you should be known for the person who freed a people. And if you want to do this, my advice would be, let's prepare properly. And what does that mean? That doesn't mean that we dance to the Israeli demands or requests, but that we strengthen everybody in the region and the Iranian people to be ready. The Kuwaitis and the Qataris and the Saudis with air defense capabilities, so that if they even can launch anything, it would not get any more than like maybe 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 feet off the ground. And I know a little bit about air defense and stuff from my background. So, you know, you always have a launch, then you have a cruise, and then you have a targeting phase. The systems nowadays should be capable, based in comparison to what Iran has, to get them basically as soon as they get in the cruise phase. And if preparation is done properly, these other countries would have also had an opportunity to do something on their own. So none of their oil or gas infrastructure would have really been threatened or destroyed, as we now know in hindsight. But the other part, and I'm a big Elon Musk fan, would have been, let's see how much Cash Patel can get more Starlinks into the country and make sure that the people on the ground, not just those that did the protests over the Christmas holidays, but millions upon millions among millions of people on the ground are ready and prepared. And I don't think it would have made or would make, if I were really in that room, I would have said, Mr. President, I don't think we are in any hurry. If we do this in June or we do this in September or we do this to get them freed up for Christmas or whatever it is, maybe we want to say we want to get this done by the 250th anniversary of the country, but we need to be properly prepared. In my opinion, even though I only have access to what the public information is, this was an extremely unprepared mission so far. And that's also why we see the results we see. The little other thing I would say is don't underestimate the fanaticism of a religiously led country, right? We in the Western public only hear about the people who protest. And I'm not saying they don't exist, but in comparison to the overall population of the country, we cannot just make the assumption that 90% of the people are just sitting there waiting for their opportunity. We need to make them ready. And we have the technological capabilities to get them ready. And we didn't do that. And Now we're all surprised. Yes, we got the supreme leader, but it's not that the millions and millions and millions, and I'm not saying they don't want to be free. I'm very, very convinced they want to be free, but they weren't prepared. They don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So that would be my thing. I would say, why the hell are you in such a hurry?
So conceptually, you would say you would be for some kind of a war. It's just the timing wasn't right. And your advice in that room would have said, don't attack right now.
Well, that's one thing. There's another component that is very important. And that is, how believable are you? Right. And because there is what we see in the public, and then there is still, I would call it diplomacy, and there is a military diplomacy, and then there's a political diplomacy. I think there would have been very easy ways to just show the people in Iraq with power what is going to come to them if they basically want to play the, you know, we will fight to the last drop and stuff like that. That goes along with kind of preparing the public, in my opinion. And then the question would have been, okay, you want to live or you don't want to live? And if you then go and do what happened in the first day of the war and ask the remaining people, okay, I ask you one more time, you want to be next or not? That's a different scenario, right? My answer to your question is, to me, looking from the outside, just on public information as we all have, this was for whatever reason done by somebody putting pressure on the president to do something unprepared. And now we are in a situation where we don't really know how to get out of it without losing face.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think it's a brilliant take on what's happening. But in their defense, I have to say that I've personally seen videos of Starlinks being captured by the IRGC as they were coming into Iran, but they should have maybe brought in it earlier. But there was a few containers of Starlink that were captured. And the Americans send in a lot of weapons also through the Kurds. It just happened that the Kurds kept the weapons and they never let it get to the Iranians. So they're not the best.
That's a matter of preparation, right? They kept them probably because nobody was willing to really tell them what they were for, at least not in plain language. The other thing, I mean, I just want to remind everybody listening to us, Starlink went into Ukraine after Russia had already started the war and had already shut down all communications. And we're talking tens of thousands of systems, right? So you're not telling me that the CIA, if properly prepared and had the time and had actually, you know, the logistical support and everything, couldn't have inundated the country with those capabilities. It's, again, if you think about it, just a matter of preparation.
All right, Axel, I'm going to change the conversation a little bit here. You spoke about this concept of inferior military battling against a superior military, that because of the lack of high-tech military hardware, they'd have to be more goal-oriented. I would love for you to describe this a bit more, how it works in a war setting, But I also want to continue the conversation and bring that back into a business sense. If a company is in competition with a much more powerful adversary, can the same logic and strategy be used in a business as compared to a war?
Well, the short answer would be yes, but I guess you want to hear a little more. From a military perspective, I think because so many people saw it, and I know the movies are never really quite the real thing, so I'm probably one of the people most aware of that. But if you think of it from a illustrative point of view, there is this scene in the Top Gun Maverick, the last kind of most recent Top Gun movie, where Maverick is basically trying to prove the point that if done right with full intentions, one plane in this very short period of time going through this insane kind of hilly mountainous terrain can deliver a kind of devastating kill on that one target. Now, they made it super gut-wrenching and, you know, like you were sitting there and looking at the clock and stuff like that. The point is, to your question, that demonstrated how much impact each individual effort has. And that it would be basically my answer to you is ultimately to say, and I'm not saying work more or work harder, right? The real answer would be smarter. But the fact is, if you have this tool, and this tool, like in this case, this fighter jet has these capabilities, then use all of it. Maximum full effort, full concentration to hit the target in this case or hit the goal. And then it really only takes one. And on the other side, oftentimes the assumption is, okay, we do everything with volume, right? And that's a little bit, in my opinion, also what I hear, to go back to August's point about the war. The U.S. military leadership right now seems to think just because we have this insane volume of weaponry that we can bring this to bear. And if anybody ever looked at the Strait of Hormuz or that little island where the oil refinery facilities are, Yeah, you know, that's a tiny little island. You can't just say, I send 1,000 jets or I send, I don't know, 1,000 missiles or stuff. And they would all not really be effective. They would probably, half of them would kill each other on the way there. So the sheer volume of power is not necessarily always the thing. Now, for business, I would say, in my experience, I mentioned earlier this approach to say, what is my goal? If you allow me, I can spend a minute on how did I actually get into this real estate stuff. I was living in Santa Barbara, California. So for most people that have ever been there, a super beautiful place, but also quite expensive. And I got fascinated with real estate investing. I saw in your video, by the way, Eva, that you said, you know, anybody successful has at some point in their life started investing in real estate and probably never stopped. So I wanted to invest in real estate, looked around, got spreadsheets and all the good stuff Germans do, and looked and came to the realization, if I want cash flowing real estate, I can't get that in Santa Barbara, California. Now, the volume approach would be to say, I need to freaking find a way to make more volume in the sense of money. Because if I have enough money, I can get properties and then maybe I can, like you guys do in multifamily, get enough students from UCSB or something like that to rent individual rooms and still make a few dollars positive cash flow. Or you can go and say, okay, what am I really looking for? What is my real goal? And what I found is my real goal is full control over the cash flowing asset. So something like a single family home, duplex, triplex, fourplex. You know the rules, the government, you know, a difference between commercial real estate and residential real estate and all that. So that the cash flow was the goal. People always said the location. Real estate is location, location, location. I'm sure you have heard that 1,000 times. No, it's performance, performance, performance. And then you have to look at the location and find the location where that performance is possible. So that got me into turnkey investing. Because that was for me the only solution to say, I'm sitting in Santa Barbara, California. I'm not going to move to Idaho or Ohio just because the properties are there. I want the properties, but I don't want to move. And the solution for that was turnkey investing. That's the goal orientation, right? Not to say I have to wait until I'm a millionaire and then I can invest. No, you have to find a way to get to your goal, even if you're not a millionaire.
Mm.
Incredible. Or like for the US military, you would say a trillionaire.
That's right. That's right.
But I love that, actually. A lot of people do say the location. Location comes first.
Yes.
But this is
performance. Yeah. Performance. But expanding on that a bit, and the reason we had as this as one of our questions for you was because of where we are. Now, the space our firm, CPI Capital, is in is we're in multifamily, but also build to rent, BTR. So we do acquisitions, already existing multifamily, utilizing the value add model while we renovate and force appreciate asset and so on in Florida and Texas. But we also do ground up development, which is building build to rent communities. So I think us expanding into build to rent was exactly that. We knew that our infrastructure in-house for acquisition was very strong for analysis and so on. Our investor relations was strong. We had equity on the sidelines ready to be deployed. It was just deals were not making sense on the multifamily side, and they were making sense for us to look at build to rent. But coming back onto, let's say, CPI, boutique smaller firm, has done a few deals, been around for 6 years now. But looking at the Goliaths in our space, looking at these Leviathan firms like, let's say, Greystar, which is the largest multifamily owner in the US, they're a property management firm as well, but they're the largest multifamily owner in the US. Interestingly enough, I want to say this is a separate component, but it's very interesting. In the multifamily space, when it comes to the market share and when it's compared to other industries, for example, banking, JP Morgan has a 17% market share. Apple has a 40% market share. Nvidia has a larger, I believe is a 60% market share. So these are, you know, online shopping. Amazon has, I think it's a 40 or 50% market share. So these are huge market shares that these companies have. Multifamily, when it comes to Greystar, which is the largest owner, is less than 0.5%.
It's like mind-blowing.
It's like 0.3% of market share. So it gives us an idea that, hey, this is not an industry where one huge firm or a few huge firms completely control it. There is an ability for us to get in. And a lot of assets that we go after, these larger firms don't go after because we're in the middle market. So, and we buy value add, not core plus. We don't buy brand new assets or just a few years old. We buy older ones that need renovation. I'm just wondering how being pragmatic, how being goal-oriented could provide support to a firm like CPI, you know, aside from ideas into bringing on a different asset class and focusing there on the multifamily side. How do we scale using this idea of being goal-oriented? Do we look inward? Because we can't control external, right? We have to look inward at team members we have or what we can do differently, for example. Hard question to answer.
I mean, my starting point, and that may not necessarily really be relevant, whether it's like BTR, which I want to congratulate you of seeing that. I mean, to me, this is very obvious, mainly because I see who are the people that will have money in the future and where do they want to live. So both through the investing lens as well as on the comfort of living lens, for me, BTR is the answer. But, you know, we can expand on that if you like. Fundamentally, though, and going back to what Eva asked earlier, is really, what do you want to accomplish with your firm? Right? For me, if you ask me the question, my goal is to help people start the development of a passive income portfolio. And size is secondary in a way, right? Because I'm not counting if I'm helping 50 people or 100 people, as long as I'm saying I'm fulfilling the mission and the vision that I have. The more the merrier, no doubt about it, but it's not a competition in the sense of who has more doors. At least in my opinion, it's not. It's a question of, for example, if you say, okay, you buy certain kinds of property because you're part of your vision is the quality of the space that you ultimately, on the one hand, provide to the tenant and on the other hand, provide to the investor. Now, for me, for example, when I'm asked, why are you not in multifamily? Or when some of my clients suggest, well, I'm thinking I might be learning from you how to buy a single family or duplex, but ultimately I want to do multifamily. My answer is control. Now, I'm not saying CPI should do this, but one way, if you wanted to differentiate yourself, would be to say, okay, would multifamily syndication be one way where you give the limited partners some more control than they would ever get in a REIT or in a Grayscale, right? So I would always say it starts out with asking yourself, why are we doing it? By the way, my personal opinion, regardless what the names are, a lot of this hedge fund investing and so forth is just as an alternative to all the different asset classes that they can be in. They're analyzing the market and saying, okay, which asset class gives us the highest probability of success to our investors? Where the investor oftentimes has no clue what they're actually investing in, if it's stocks, if it's ETFs, if it's commodities or real estate, they only want to see either directly or indirectly that their mutual fund makes 5 or 6% per year, right? And then they look at, obviously, as next step, they look at how many fees can we collect for that. You and I, you with your company, I with my company, and thousands of others like us, we are much, much closer at the face and at the contact with the investor. In our companies, at least I believe from what I saw on your website and what you're doing and your content, you are also much more involved with the people that actually invest with you, or where you basically offer a product. And same with me. So the intention is different. The vision is different. And then you have to ask yourself, do you really even have to care about the market share or what other people do and what their motivation is? Right. I mean, if you take this step back one moment and say, okay, if you wanted to start a car company, would you ever have started an electric car company? Most people would say, well, if I would have any chance of success, I start a car company. Even that has not been successful in 100 years in the United States. And Tesla started as an electric car company, which was double hard. But the point was, electrified transportation was the vision. It wasn't just, I want to make a cool electric car. It was getting our transportation electrified so we don't have the potential impacts of climate change. The vision, completely different from the Fords, the GMs, from the Mercedes or BMWs, right? That would be my answer to you. Ask yourself, what is your vision and the thing that you want to accomplish, and be 100% focused on that, and let the rest of the world do their thing and their focus on their vision.
Incredible response. Great.
Yeah, very nice.
I love that, Axel. Thank you.
I've heard you speak about this concept before on other shows, so I wanted to bring it back because it's something that interests me. So you described this idea, not, I'm paraphrasing you, but you described this idea of mechanical performance versus artistic performance. And you talked about in aviation, particularly in the military, where it's almost muscle memory, right? It's not your reactive brain, it's your limbic brain. But you also discuss this concept that some people are just better at it. You talk about landing or taking off from a certain, or actually, it's got to be landing. You're landing in a runway where you never landed before, but your muscle memory makes decisions that somebody sitting next to you says, thinks that you've already have flown into that airport in the past because you are interpreting it differently than somebody else would. And you're doing that creative part, the artistic part, much more smoothly. Now, I've always wondered about this in many different practices in life. Some people just do things much better than others. Some people are more mechanical. Some people are more artistic. But I always wondered about the world of medicine, right? Particularly surgical medicine. And I have a good friend of mine who is a surgeon. He's a urologist, and he does actually surgical for bladder and kidneys and what have you. And I asked this question from him, like, when you're in the operating room, is it noticeable right away that some surgeons are just really better than others? And what if some surgeon is getting the job done, but they're just not artistic enough to get the job done the right way? Do they lose their job? What happens? It's like, no, it happens in medicine. And there are some people that just are not the best, even though they've done the schooling, they've done all the practical work, but they're just not the best. So they have to, you know, move on to something else. But some people are just great at it. Now, I want to bring that back for you to discuss the concept a bit more, but discussing that also in life as well. For example, with CPI, when Ava, myself, and another partner of ours started CPI, we initially had different positions within the company. I was initially investor relations, and I thought I was doing a decent job until Ava started connecting with investors and getting on calls. And after just listening into a few calls and the performance, I soon realized that this was terrible idea for me to be in this position at all, because I'm very analytical. I talk with my hands. I'm a bit loud. You know, I say it how it is. Last thing I want. And when I'm talking to investors, I'm a man. I'm a strong man. Last thing I want is asking for somebody for money. It almost feels like I'm begging for money. So it didn't feel good personality-wise, but Ava was incredible. Like, it was unbelievable the type of people getting on calls with her and investing with us. So she took the reins there right away because she was just better at that. Talk to us about this concept, how it plays into business and life, and love to hear more about it.
Yeah, so it's not, I guess, explained or addressed in a sentence or two. The first starting point is to say, am I doing something? Am I learning something that I'm actually interested in? Because interest in talent is oftentimes kind of on the same side, so to speak, right? If you are forced to do something that you are totally not interested in and potentially also not talented for, it's probably not going to be good. It might be like what you just described. You know, I'm not saying you're not talented, but it may not be serving your talents well compared to what you said that you do, and what you're doing as CFO now is probably closer to your talents. And so you want to first find something that is aligned with your talents, just to get started of learning whatever is needed to learn to get reasonably good at it. Now, the comparison between you and Ava is also not quite right, because a female has much more intuition and emotional connection and stuff. You and I could never compete with Ava, right? So that's just, we have to put that aside. It's kind of like not totally fair. But even, you know, if we were both equally talented and interested with something, there comes a point where you can say, okay, I learned, we spoke earlier about all the rules or the standard operating procedures we use and learn how to apply all the tools and so forth and so forth. And to your example with the surgery, there's obviously also procedures. There are tools to apply. There is the knowledge of, you know, how the body looks like on the outside, the knowledge on how it works and how it looks like on the inside when you start the surgery and make your first incisions. And then one thing that happens that is an important attribute is experience. And what that actually does is, okay, so you are fundamentally talented in performing certain tasks in a certain order to achieve a certain goal. Now you're doing it more and more and more, meaning like you're gaining experience, and you can get better and better in just doing the mechanical part. And where talent and this kind of artistic part comes in is to say, okay, do I see things that go a little left and right, above and beyond what the book says, so to speak, right? Where you say, okay, well, this particular patient that I just opened for this bladder surgery, the bladder is much bigger than the x-rays show. Or what we thought was the bladder was actually part of the bladder and a hernia. Right. Now you could say, okay, well, that's totally new. Let's close it up. Let's go back to the beginning and see what we do. Or in a way, the artist, and I am not talking about medical law and all that, I'm just talking about the situation, is to say, okay, I can find a solution by asking a nurse to give me a tool that normally has nothing to do with the surgery to move this hernia part out of the way, really analyze the bladder in the moment, in situ, and make a decision that is the best possible decision aligned with my talents to help the patient, right? And the more you do this, the more you become aware that all the stuff you do, you're doing the incision and later on you're doing the sutures and you might do the most beautiful sutures and stuff. That all becomes what you call in aviation, knowing the thing inside out, knowing where all the buttons are and doing this almost like subconsciously. And what's interesting in my experience is that you are basically freeing up brain capacity. I like the analogy of driving. If you are somebody who always drives from A to B to get to work, and you're driving the same route every day, there comes a moment or the point where somebody might say, hey, August, can we have this call a little bit earlier than normal? I know you're on your way. Can you put it on your phone? I know this is a little weird, but can we do the Zoom call on the phone? And you say, well, I'm not normally doing this, but let's try it. And you put it in your little phone holder and you do the Zoom thing. And you can have the Zoom call and you're getting from A to B, no problem. You wouldn't even know that there were a few new signs or stuff. Your subconscious just drove you from A to B. At the moment where there is a construction, on your day-to-day route, and you now have done this 5 times, but you have to go a different route to do the construction, you will probably say, hey guys, sorry, I can't do the call right now. I need to concentrate on driving. And the artist is so talented that he or she can still do both. Because, and the surgeon is so talented and so artistic to say, yeah, I have all these kind of unexpected circumstances and I'm not giving up. I'm willing to try something that goes above and beyond the norm or the procedure or the binder in the shelf system, like I mentioned earlier. And the more you do this, the more you're developing your artistry. Another analogy that I like to give that also applies to business. I see myself, and I oftentimes encourage people that I work with, and maybe this applies for you or you want to apply it for yourself, is to see your role as the conductor of an orchestra. Right. And when you go to that analogy and you say, does the conductor need to be able to play every instrument to the artistic level of the number one violist and the number one cello player and the number one bassist or stuff like that? No. Right. The role of the leader is to be the conductor of the orchestra. But even that has artistry, because if it wouldn't, we wouldn't differentiate between like the New York Symphony and some kind of like small town high school band. So that recognition, artistry in basically the instrument, artistry in surgery, artistry in how we lead our business, is the aspect that goes above and beyond the expected procedure. And it takes talent, it takes obviously energy, vision, it takes the willingness to try. That's actually, by the way, besides if you have all the other things and you are somebody who says, I feel so closed in that I'm not trying to do anything different, then we are back to your earlier question to say, how can a smaller company in the same space succeed against these big Goliaths? And I mean, in industry and business, we have seen it. Either you're a disruptor in the way and what you're offering, like all the ones you read it down, they were all disrupting the industry that they were in or wanted to be in initially. Or you did something different and better than anybody else. And that requires to be willing to go a little bit above and beyond, to be willing to try something. And obviously, you can try better when you already have a wealth of information and experience. You don't want to have an apprentice try all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah. But when you're working your way to the either the artistry, I also lately like to use the term mastery. Right. If you have to go to master something or reach mastery, there comes a point where the normal procedure set is just not applying or working anymore.
I love that. Yeah. Thanks for that, Axel.
That's thank you so much.
Incredible.
It's a guest that we have to get back on the show. So I'm literally going to send Axel an invite to come back on the show
we have
next
questions,
time.
But we're
we have a lot more questions, a lot more stuff to cover, but let's get to our next segment of our show if you're ready for this.
The 10 championships to financial freedom. The 10 championship rounds to financial freedom.
You've only done it 400 times, Ava.
Could be balls.
Yeah, exactly. There's 10 questions, Axel. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's get into it. First question, who's been the most influential person in your life?
For business, probably my grandpa.
Touch on it a little bit.
Yeah,
if you like.
I would love to learn more.
Well, he had a lot of those sayings that in the beginning didn't really make much sense, right? But he enforced things like punctuality. He enforced something that has always served me very well, is respect people for who they are, not where they come from. Or how I should put in parentheses, or how they look like. Right? Meaning like color or heritage or any of those kind of things. Another one that he had, or that he oftentimes said, is for me, the interaction with somebody, let's take like we have not met before. If we were to somehow do business or just hang out, I would say August and Ava, the barrel is full. The only thing that you could do is screw it up. But this notion that you have to earn respect, you have to earn the engagement, you have to earn your standing, he said, no. Treat people at 100% level as if they have everything that you could ever expect and they can screw it up. You're not the one that's screwing it up. You know. So that's one of them. Then he had another one that I really liked when I started looking into stock investing, was don't ever believe a statistic that you didn't manipulate yourself. So those kind of things and a few others.
Nice.
All right.
I love that. Next question, Axel. What is the number one book you would recommend?
Well, there are so many. One that has really been profound that I've recommended many times is called The Wealthy Gardener by John Sophoric.
Wow. We haven't had that one before.
What is it about?
John wrote that book to prepare his son for the financial world. But the story is basically about somebody who built a farm from almost nothing, became wealthy without being kind of one of those shiny object wealthy people, and is now looking who could actually help his son to be successful. But I think if I remember right, he said he knows, the farmer knows that he's going to die pretty soon. So that's kind of like the setting. And it has many, many really, really helpful little sayings or little kind of things. You know, the beautiful thing that John did is if you go to the website for the Wealthy Gardener, it takes all these little quotes and you can click on them and it gives you a little bit of a vignette of what they're about and where you find them in the book. So even after you read the book and you say, I can't really remember 89 different things, but you can go back and check in with them.
Oh, I love that. We'll add that to our list to read. Perfect. Thanks for that. Next question. If you had the opportunity to travel back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
It brings back this grandpa thing. I would tell myself to ask him a little bit more detail exactly what he's doing with the newspaper.
Okay.
Now, to explain this, he went to work. He was a patent lawyer. Went to work in the morning, came back. I was raised basically by my grandma. My parents dropped myself and my sister off in the morning, went to work, and then picked us up like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening. And so he came back like about 4:30, 5-ish in the afternoon. And the first thing he did, he brought the newspaper, took it out, threw everything away except for the business section, took out the pencil and started annotating stuff. And even though he taught me a few things, but I never really asked deep enough. Then many years later, I was grown. I was out and doing my thing. He died. And everybody was shocked that he had a six-figure stock portfolio. Wow. Nobody knew.
Wow. Interesting. So
now I have to say this was 1981 when he died. You know, okay. So it's been a while. Wow. That was really something for somebody at that time, regular, normal person, employee.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I should have asked.
Very interesting.
Next question, Axel. What's the best investment you've ever made?
For really investment, Palantir.
Okay. And that was...
I started watching YouTube videos, came across a guy named Tom Nash, and he was talking about this company that will revolutionize or help us revolutionize because they are an AI company that nobody was taking seriously. Because they were seen as a consulting company. He said from the first time I watched it, no, they're not a consulting company. They're really an AI company. And they had gone IPO with like $50 or $60 a share and then crashed down to six. And I started listening. This is kind of interesting. And then when they got to 10, I had understood enough to say, I think I need to get into this. Mm-hmm. And by now, I mean, today they might be at 130. They have been up to 200. So that was basically 20x my money. I wish I would have done more, well, right? Yeah. But I have never had anything that's 10x or 20x or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Palantir, it is controversial. You got Peter Thiel as one of their initial investors, and they have a component with intelligence and doing... you know, surveillance on American public and all this stuff. So there is a huge movement on X against Palantir and its founder who's got his crazy hair and all that stuff. But yeah, no, that's great. Let's go to the next one.
Next question, Axel, what's the worst investment you've ever made and what lessons did you learn from it?
Well, I was involved while I was still in the Air Force in what we called a little stock investment club, where we all had very little money and very little understanding of investment, but we said, well, we can probably do something like $100 a month, you know, just to learn about the market, which we actually didn't in hindsight. And we said, well, with that little money, we can only really do penny stocks. And that, you have to keep in mind, was at the time, at the late 90s, when every, you know, pet.com and august.com and ava.com and everything came out. So we had all kinds of like, and then the dot-com bubble burst and it kind of was almost like a flock of pigeons and the cat came by and they all flew.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
All right. Perfect.
Okay, next question, Axel. How much did you need in the bank to retire today? What's your number?
In the bank?
Yeah. How much would you need?
It's more of a metaphorical question, but how much, like, you know, is there a dollar amount you need to retire today? I know you're somewhat retired already, but yeah.
I mean, I don't look at it that way. And that's why I'm also a little bit taken aback. I'm looking at the cash flow side and would say about 8,000 a month.
Nice. Yeah. He's done his numbers.
Right. Like, I mean, the bank, if you were to look at my bank accounts, I probably have no more than like 10 grand in the bank because it's just wasting away there. So my money is invested all over the place.
Perfect. Nice work. Next question, Axel. If you could have dinner with someone dead or alive, who would it be?
Well, yeah. That's, again, so many choices. Still, I think I have to say Elon.
Nice.
Yeah, it's probably the most common answer we get for that question.
Choice, yeah.
That's the most common.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm watching a lot of stuff and there are some things that I'm so annoyed I can't even put it in words why nobody asked it. You know? It's getting a little better, but I don't know why people don't watch previous interviews to come up with different questions, but have him get him asked the same thing over and over and over again. And he obviously gives the same answer over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I would have also really, I mean, opportunistically, I would probably have to say Warren Buffett because I don't know. I wish he has another 25 years, but it's probably unrealistic. You know, so my philosophy is literally what he said, only buy stuff and be invested in stuff that you understand. And I would like to poke into that a little more. You know.
Nice.
Also, why do you have $300 billion in the bank? I kind of want to know.
Yeah. Why exactly?
Yeah. So for this next question, I mean, go ahead, ask it. And I've just got to preface it.
Of course. So the next question, Axel, is if you weren't doing what you're doing today, what would you be doing now?
Well, you've had both careers, right? You know, Air Force now with coaching and wealth building and a real estate investor. But was there something you ever aspired to be in? Something, something you wanted to be a race car driver or something else? Like, was there anything else in life you ever thought about doing?
Well, I drove the fastest race cars around, so I wouldn't want that. People actually asked me if I wanted to do airplanes, right? I said, I had like NASCAR, Formula One, whatever analogy. Why would I want to do a school bus, right? Like, right. Anyway, or Airbus for that matter. So no, what I'm still dreaming about, and I don't know, I haven't really quite given up, is I would like to do a little eco-village on the hillside overlooking the Mediterranean.
Okay, nice.
You know, that would be my thing. I would plant edible hedges everywhere, nothing that is just green, you know, like, you know, why not do wine or like the trees would be like mandarins and peaches and nectarines and stuff, right? And then maybe at the bottom have something for RVs if they just want to come through and hang out for a little while. And like these, I don't know if they're tiny homes or casitas or something like that. In a terrace, I have the whole thing in my head.
I love that. That's awesome.
Almost like a part-time, not farmer, but somebody who runs a vineyard or what is it, small?
In a way. I mean, farm. I have a friend who is specializing, for example, in reclaiming water and architecture that is basically reclaiming things, right? So that would be something, and everything, every little roof and opportunity would have a solar panel, and I would probably have a mega pack from Tesla in somewhere hidden in the forest. Nice. To store the energy. Stuff, right? Like,
nice.
Yeah, so that ideally I would make it not just for myself, but for other people to enjoy it, but making it totally environmentally self-sustaining. Yeah.
Nice.
Love that. Love that. Next question, my favorite question. Book smarts or street smarts?
The one first and then the other.
Oh, okay. Book smarts first and then street smarts. I like that. That's what we're going to instill in our sons.
Nice.
Do you want to talk about that at all? Or?
Well, the thing about it is, I mean, I give one quick example that applies to myself, right? I was told that if I wanted to be successful in business after the military, I should get a degree. Now, I had a bachelor's degree, but that somehow was supposedly not counting properly. So I went to a university to get a graduate degree. And the question was, what are you interested in? We're back at the very beginning of our interview today. And I said, I'm really interested in seeing how leadership works in business, since I was involved and had lots of 22 years experience in the military. So I studied that all the way to a PhD in leadership and organizational management. and was working in a software company as an executive. And that was about like as much clashing two sides, the reality of how the founder ran his business and what I learned in theory, book smarts, right? So I did it the wrong way around. I was living it as an executive in a company, pretty hierarchically organized by the founder, and then getting the book smarts. And it led to me to say, okay, I can't do this any longer. I quit and start my own thing, because if what I'm learning is applicable and I'm learning it because I'm believing in it, then I have to show that it can be done, right? And so I wish I would have done it the other way around, then I would have never worked for that company.
And you would, exactly. Okay, so book smarts is street smart. Last question, Axel, if you had $1 million in cash and you had to make one investment today, what would it be?
Today? If I had to do it today, I would probably buy Tesla.
Okay.
It's trading at 300% earnings compared to anything else. It's like 5x to earn, like compared to the next one in line, let's say NVIDIA. It is the most inflated company.
Can I borrow your time machine? I want to take August and put him in when Steve Jobs and Bill Gates went to IBM. And they said that about personal computers. Or when Jeff Bezos said, we're going to make it so that people can buy everything online. Or to Nokia, when somebody said, did you see these crazies there at Apple? They have touch screens. They honestly believe nobody wants buttons and little blueberry wheels anymore. And we can go for a year-long trip, August, to hear those statements. That's all I have to say.
All right.
By the way, Eva, if you didn't have said today, but maybe in June, I would probably have said SpaceX.
Okay, right on. Okay.
Sounds good. I think SpaceX just bought Grok. So they just bought their AI company. So they're going public soon, right? Or something is happening?
Yeah, supposedly in June or July. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. But I wouldn't buy it for Grok or XAI or stuff like that. I think what SpaceX has built and is building is really literally going to be our future.
Wow. All right. Great.
Axel, just quickly let everybody listening, what's the best way that they can reach you, please?
Well, if you go in any kind of platform of any kind and put in Ideal Wealth Grower, then you find our social media presence or our website. And if you go there at the top right-hand corner, there's a little button that says Discovery Call. And that gets you on my calendar. We talk just like we have been talking, the three of us here today. And we see if there's something that I can help you with.
How do you spell it?
Ideal, like I-D-E-A-L, Wealth Grower.
IdealWealthGrower.com, yes. Right?
Perfect.
Thank you so much,
Axel. This was incredible.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. We hope this conversation enlightened you on how to win big in this highly profitable and risk-averse space. Get on your feet and embrace this world that offers so many opportunities just waiting for you out there. Continue your journey to becoming a savvy real estate expert by subscribing to the show at cpicapital.ca. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and share with your friends. See you on the next one.